Eating Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Emily Intravia, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies.
That's right. We've got Emily back on. She has been a guest two or three times on the show.
We still haven't figured that out. I think two, maybe?
I think two. Yeah, because we met last year at the late night chat room back in New York City. And then I had you on relatively soon after that, and then earlier this year during when we were watching Red Tails.
Of course, that classic Oscar bait. Watch out, Oscars.
That classic George Lucas masterpiece.
Finally going to stand on that stage.
That's right. Anyways, before we get along and remind you of who Emily is and what she does and where you can find her, let's go through the paperwork here. You can go to fatguysatthemovies.com and listen to all of our different podcasts. I think we're even doing like a bonus Idiot Boxers episode on, is that Homeland? Is that the one with, no, not Homeland.
The Newsroom.
That's the one. With Aaron Sorkin and Dev Patel looking exactly like Dev Patel does in every other movie except for The Last Airbender. You can go to iTunes and find all of our podcasts. Just search Fat Guys in the Movies. You can go to Facebook.com/FGATM and you can like us. Please like us. We enjoy that. You can email us, fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com. We have an email this week, so we will read that in the third segment. You can give us a voicemail at 740 area codes 740-205-6456, and you can reach me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr. Emily, remind everybody who you are and where we can find you.
I am a human being. My name is Emily.
You can, we don't you can have robots on the show.
But yeah, I should probably refrain from giving my address.
The way you say that, you can find me in the Bronx. Just find the street corner.
No, if you blow your whistle upon the hour and do something, I don't know. I apparently flutter down from the sky.
I have a totally different version of the Bronx than you just described.
You don't know, man. It's different now, you know?
It's like got fairies and pixie dust and,
I live near the zoo.
Unicorns.
I mean, I work in the prostitute section of the Bronx.
I love how I say you have fairies and unicorns, and you're like, well, I work near the zoo.
I live near the zoo, and I work with the prostitutes. No, I do. The one thing I will say is, I work in an area that is known for its nightlife. But during the day, it's just industrial, I swear. I don't talk about that online generally. You can find me. I talk about generally horror and really bad movies over at deadlydollshouse.com. And you can hear me. I do Gleecast, the podcast, which you can find.
Do you still
iTunes.
Do Gleecast?
We're still doing it. We're trying to figure out if there's a way we can seamlessly change things to instead be about Game of Thrones. While still called without having to change our like podomatic domain and everything.
I cannot imagine any two more disparate shows.
In my dream world, it would actually be a show about Oz.
You mean the old prison show on HBO?
I mean the old prison show on HBO. Like if there was a way to segue from Glee to Oz, which somehow I'm able to do a lot.
I've watched Glee. I think you can segue. I don't know if you can segue to Game of Thrones as easily.
No, there's very few. I'm usually good at finding connecting threads. There are very few. Like, I found one. I was so excited when I rewatched Batman Begins and realized King Joffrey is a little boy in Batman Begins. And it was the most exciting thing in the world to realize that and imagine a world where if in Batman Begins, the actor playing King Joffrey, his character was killed in Batman Begins, if that would have changed things for Game of Thrones and what kind of universe we'd have.
Wow.
And yet I don't know how that relates to Glee, so.
I think that my brain exploded just trying to contemplate all of that.
It happens a lot. Usually the pieces go back together pretty easily.
Yes. Well, that's good. I'll pick them up later. Anyways, that's how you can find Emily. Just go to the prostitute section in the Bronx and you'll find her.
Or
just
on Twitter. I'm Deadly Dolls on Twitter. That also works.
Okay, that works too.
It's easier than sifting through all the ladies.
I don't know if that sounds any better or not. Anyway. Let's do our first movie. We're getting in too much trouble here. The first movie is The Watch, in which Ben Stiller and Vince Vaughn dumb down attack the block with a neighborhood watch instead of street kids in London.
There is an alien invasion happening.
They're among us.
That's why I founded the Neighborhood Watch.
Any one of these people could be an alien.
Check her out.
We're not going to let Glenview be ground zero for some alien invasion.
We can't trust anyone.
Look at his face.
Look at my face.
Look at his face and listen to me.
Look at him and listen to me.
Look at me.
Look at me.
Look at him and understand me. Look at both of us, but understand no one. Listen to my words
and hear his face.
They did not screen this for us, so I have no idea how this is. You obviously didn't see it because you don't.
I've seen the trailer a lot.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of
it. The trailer doesn't. I mean, I usually hate trailers for comedies because they're usually going to show the really easy jokes that are going to have everybody in the theater go, oh, or they're going to show like the one really good joke and then you're going to go see the movie and it's not in there. Or you already know it. But I will admit, I thought there were moments in the trailer that were kind of like, oh, okay, that was funny. That could work.
My worry about the watch is the same, is that it's going to be like what happened with Anger Management, where you kind you have to tell the whole story of like the first hour just so you know what the movie's about. Because the story is about this, you think, oh, this is a goofy neighborhood watch, these people are taking their job too seriously. Then there's aliens showing up. And it's almost like you, I'm wondering if the movie's going to have like a half hour of silliness with the neighborhood watch and then the aliens show up and that's supposed to be a big twist. But you know it because that's the premise
exactly
of the movie.
Exactly how they're advertising it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know if they, I mean, I know they changed the title, but I'm curious if they changed the advertising to make the aliens so obvious rather than, if what you're saying is, if your theory is right, that maybe it is about a neighborhood watch and then there's aliens. And that's kind of a surprise. But they kind of couldn't say that because after the shooting and everything else, it was like, no, it's aliens. It's not a neighborhood watch.
Oh, so, have they done that? Have they changed
it? I don't know. I believe the title was The Neighborhood Watch. I don't know if I'm right about that.
No, it was always called The Watch.
It was called The Watch?
Yeah, they didn't like change it in the last week. So.
It seemed like it was something I remember when that was kind of higher priority, I guess, in the news. That was a big thing of how is it going to affect this movie? And I guess we'll find out.
It could be just it's not that good of a movie. I don't know. It looks like it could be funny, but I don't know. It does seem, at least the trailer seem a bit derivative of Attack the Block. And Attack the Block was such a fun movie.
I loved Attack the Block.
And so it had such energy that it's almost like...
And it was so different, even though it was also, you know, resting on other movies, it just felt really fresh.
Yeah.
And so now you're seeing this movie, which is actors who never feel fresh anymore because they all think they're really good at what they do.
I
don't have high hopes. It's something I wouldn't pay to go see, but I wouldn't be surprised if I catch it eventually on instant watch and say, oh, that was better than I thought it would be.
I have a feeling it's going to be one of those movies that comes and goes and people will completely forget about it. And even if it's decent, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I'm going to go check it out this weekend. And you can check the Fat Guys feed for the review. We're actually going to jump ahead and do the next movie. We have to give the watch a preemptive suck because we didn't see it. We're going to do the next movie, which is Ruby Sparks. And this is a struggling writer, a writer struggling with love, and a new book invents the perfect girl, and who suddenly becomes real in his existence.
I'm glad you found something that inspires you.
Inspires me.
It's like I'm falling in love with her.
That's wonderful.
I can't fall in love with a girl I write.
Why not?
Because she's not real.
I missed you in bed last night. Did you get some good writing done?
Colin, are you mad at me?
Remember how Dad used to say I had an overactive imagination?
That's good.
Calvin, but there's no possible way that Ruby's in your house because she's not a real person.
Can you see her?
Calvin!
She's real.
All right. We got about 10 seconds here, and I'll just say really quickly, this movie's not my kind of film. And I said to Emily on show prep that it's sort of like Stranger Than Fiction and 500 Days of Summer had a kid, and this is what you get. I'll expound on that in the next segment. Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. We were talking real briefly about Ruby Sparks before going into the break, but I'll go ahead and finish this up here. This movie already has these sort of these flags that go up, these red flags for me of things I don't like in movies. First of all, it's about the stories being Paul Dano is a writer, and he sort of like peaked when he was like 19 and wrote the Great American Novel and has been trying
Why
to
Why do so many indie films think that it's special to have a character who's a writer?
That's one of my big stories about writers, because here's the thing. I'm a writer. I make a living writing. Every job I've ever had has involved writing on a professional level. I've been a textbook writer. I've been a copywriter. I've been a professional editor. I've written for newspapers. So I am, in fact, a writer. I never walk around and identify myself, I'm a writer.
Right, you don't, like, carry a notebook and, like, moleskin with a pen and do most of your best work in a park. Really? You don't do that?
No, well, and the other thing is I hate that, because whenever I meet people, I'm like, well, as a writer, if you start a like that, that means you're not a real writer. You're somebody who wants to be a writer. You're the person who wants to go back into Midnight in Paris and meet Hemingway and write with him and talk.
When I was in college, I was actually a playwriting major in college.
Oh.
And we had we had a lot of guests come to my college to visit. We had Susan Laurie Parks, who a very famous playwright, you know, Pulitzer Prize winner. And one of the greatest things she said in the class when, like, you know, people were asking her about, you know, what it's like to be a writer, blah, she said, well, the most important thing is, you know, you can't want to be a writer. You have to love the act of writing, not the act of being a writer.
Yeah.
And movies do that. And it's not fun to watch because I watch them thinking the same thing. Like, I mean, I write and you know, I don't need somebody to make a movie about me sitting there thinking of how I'm not inspired. Of course I'm not, because I'm not actively going after something. And that's why movies about writers are generally terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is what and it's written by Zoe Kazan, who plays the girl in it. And so it is, of course, very... It's her, she's a playwright, and she's writing. And so it is very, oh, I'm a writer. You have that angsty...
Her hair probably looks great because all writers take a lot of care in their hair of it.
Well, but she's not even the writer. She's the object, and he creates this character, and she kind of comes to life, and miraculously. So it reminded me a little bit of Stranger Than Fiction, even though I thought Stranger Than Fiction is a far, far better movie. Stranger Than Fiction's okay, but it's really not about a writer. It's about a guy who's a character.
Right. It's kind of, which is more interesting because it's sort of about writing. But you don't have to have, you know, a novelist as your lead in order to get that.
Yeah, and even though there's a writer in it, Emma Thompson plays a writer. She's she's a secondary character.
Right. Thompson, so she can do anything.
Absolutely. And the best movie ever about a writer, and they don't need to write anything more. They don't need to do any more movies about writer, is Adaptation. It's probably the best movie about writers. Have you seen Adaptation? You've seen Adaptation.
I haven't. You know, it's embarrassing to say. I actually have not sat down and watched it beginning to end.
It's a fascinating film because it's so unique, and it really kind of shows. It really puts itself in. It doesn't angst about being a writer. It's more or less. It pokes fun at itself, sort of in a. Oh, who's the guy who did? What was that movie with? Oh my God! I'm pulling a Fozzie.
The movie with
Paul Giamatti playing the underground comic artist, American Splendor. It really feels like that, where it's just poking fun at his Harvey Parker or parkour or whatever. Parkour.
He was really flexible.
He was jumping around
and worked out a lot.
Yeah.
And somehow ended up looking like Paul Giamatti. It was a metabolism thing, I guess.
You know, it's glandular problem. But no, Ruby Sparks it's one of those. There's a point in the movie where I was like, you know what? If it didn't start the same way, and it started, and you didn't know that this was the thing, and could have been a great reveal, but since you kind of are with it from the beginning, it's just a little mundane. And it has that 500 Days of Summer. Only he's not in that one. He's an architect, because there's another brilliantly never before written character, an architect.
How many architects do you know in life?
My cousin.
Yeah.
My cousin's an architect, but she's the only one.
Right. Like, my uncle's an architect, and then I know no others.
And the thing is, it's not that
people
great
love
of a job.
Making movies about architects. I don't get it.
I do not understand why it's like, is it a Mike Brady thing? I don't know what's going on.
That did imprint a lot of people. Wait, now, question about Ruby Sparks. Is Zoe Kazan related to Elia Kazan?
Oh, gosh, I have no
idea. Guy. Is there, I don't know.
She could be his daughter for all.
Maybe granddaughter, right? I don't know.
Well, you never know.
Making that up.
You know,
we don't know.
James Doohan was having kids at like 80.
That's true. Look at Anthony Quinn, right?
Yeah.
He had like 30 of them in his 90s.
I have a friend named Chris, and Chris loves these. He loved 500 Days of Summer. Did you ever see the movie? Waiting for Forever?
What a bad title.
Rachel Bilson, and I forget who the guy was, and it's him. The character's trying to do like being like a Benny and June character. But he's just failing miserably. He's not sticking the landing on any of it. And because he's not Johnny Depp. Mm-hmm. And it is that sort of like, oh, I love the free spirit.
That's the thing. Forced whimsy is the most painful, to me, film experience one can have. Because it's one thing when it works and it, you know, like, I mean, Garden State, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, like, I am so into this movie. If I were to watch a movie again now, I think I would just want to hurt someone.
Well, and it seems like every movie that's coming out of Fox Searchlight now is about some person in their mid to late 20s.
And life's kind of hard for them, but they still have a really good wardrobe.
Yeah, and they're really struggling with some relationship. And I'm just like, maybe it's because I'm 40 and I'm married and I got kids. So I'm so beyond that. But I was never like that when I was in my 20s either. I kind of had my stuff together at that time.
It's the rent disease for me, which is, you know, in 1996, like when I was, you know, a teenager, I thought Rent was this great statement about being an artist. When you know, especially with the movie, which was painful for many other reasons. But when you look at that now, you're just like, dude, just pay your rent. Just get a job. Work at Starbucks and write your music at night. Yeah. Like, it's not that hard. That's what everybody does. You can't expect me to trust you as an artist when you haven't produced anything.
Yeah. And I'm tired of
now. It makes me feel old.
I'm tired of movies about, oh, this guy falling in love with a free spirit. She's so wacky.
It's
a
diplomatic 60 Dream Girl.
Yeah,
thing,
and I hate, I don't find that
obnoxious
attractive.
Obnoxious and offensive. And it's ruined movies for me. It ruined when I went back to Harold and Maude and watched it post all of these other movies, I was like, oh, Maude is kind of a manic pixie dream girl, and she's
just old.
She's kind of, yeah, she's just an older version of one. And, you know, they're kind of mean to other people. They make life hard for everyone. But she's wacky.
Like, that's the way I am.
She's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't
is
like
related
that.
To the Kazans, by the way.
And they literally have one line in there where he says something else. So what happened? She goes, and her character's 24 years old, because they actually say that.
Oh,
in the movie. 24 years old.
I can't watch a movie about a 24-year-old.
And then she's like, oh, what happened? Oh, I was really young then. I'm like, you're really young now. 24? What do you mean you were really young then? You're 24. You've been able to drink for 3 years legally. I mean, you haven't even been able to legally. That's what irritates me. I'm tired of these stories, and I'm tired of the weepy, mopey guy.
There's an audience out there. You know, there are 20-year-olds who are going to love the movie, maybe.
Yeah.
But I'm 30 and that offends me.
Yeah, and my friend Chris is going to love it because he loves these kind of things. And I've realized it's a Chris movie, and I generally don't like these films. Right. So that one kind of sucks. Let's move on to the next one, which is the big movie of the weekend. The one I've been avoiding Twitter because I don't want any spoilers. That's right. Biggest opening weekend ever. Step Up Revolution. Girl meets boy. Boy and girl dance. Boom! Revolution.
Topping our local headlines, Miami Beach was transformed today into what some are describing as art, others a public disturbance. The question on everyone's mind is, who is the mob?
Didn't you ever want to be a part of something different, something special? The mob is our way to shout.
I want in.
Their videos quickly going viral. These local dancers are turning into something of a cultural phenomenon.
20,000 hits in under 5 hours.
It's time for us to be heard.
Excited.
All right. Now, I'm glad I had you on the show because I know you're a huge fan of the Step Up movies.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Step Up 2 and 3.
That's right, because you hate Channing Tatum in Step Up 1.
Step Up 1 is just a bad movie. It's everybody in it is working at low energy. Channing Tatum didn't learn how to speak yet. You can't understand a word he says. Rachel Griffiths from 6 Feet Under is in it, and she's awful, and she's a brilliant actress. But you can't understand a word she says. The dancing is eh. It's not that great. The story is essentially Save the Last Dance. And then, spoiler alert, for no reason, they throw in a tragedy where a young kid dies.
Well, you know, it was early 2000s. So.
I guess that's what was happening back then. But it's just, it's ugly. Like, it's, you know, it's set somewhere in the suburbs of Baltimore, which part two is set in Baltimore, but part two just has this life about it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me of this is a franchise that is understanding itself as it goes along and is getting better with each movie. And I thought Step Up 3D was a blast.
It's fun.
It's so fun. And to me, I don't know how you feel about this. Okay. I still say, without irony, Step Up 3D was the best use of 3D I've seen.
Oh, I will say this, and even this first Step Up Revolution, it's in 3D. The dance sequences are fantastic in 3D. I mean, it's cool to see. It is.
Yeah.
It's a visual movie. It is a dance movie version of Transformers.
And they've found a way to use 3D, I think, in a really different way. And I know Step Up 3D, I didn't think it did that well in the theaters. And from what I understood, the 3D didn't do that well, though, did it?
It was at a time where people were just not paying the extra price. Mm-hmm. But they tend to be profitable on their own. Actually, we got
to
go to a break.
To make.
Yeah, we got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll talk more.
miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck, 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck. Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We were talking about the epic blockbuster, sure to be Oscar-nominated, Step Up Revolution. Spoiler.
Watch out, Dark Knight Rises.
Spoiler, they do dance.
And do they revolution?
There is a bit of a revolution happening. Here's the skinny on Step Up Revolution. I have a certain appreciation for the Step Up movies. I'm not a wild fan of them, but I think they're fun because that's what they are. They're just fun. They're just dancing movies. Yeah. That's really all they are.
Oh no, there is no importance to these films. They are just delicious bubblegum.
Yeah, here's the thing. The story, plot, characters, absolutely fucking ridiculous.
I don't know what those words mean.
Completely ridiculous, and there's parts in this movie that make no goddamn sense whatsoever.
As they did not in 3 either.
Yeah, and that's par for the course. But so, I mean, they're hard to get over. If you want to go and you just want to see the dance movies and you want to see the, you know, the good-looking people dancing around, it delivers. I will tell you that. It delivers. It has some very cool and unique dance sequences. Those are easily the best parts of the film. Again, story makes no goddamn sense whatsoever.
Does it have any weird underlying white supremacist messages like part 2 does?
No, it does. It's not that. It has a whole corporate greed angle. Here's the thing, because after the whole Occupy movement, it's like people were like trying to latch onto that with their movies. You know, had like Tower Heist. Even The Dark Knight Rises is latching on a bit to that. Yeah. You know, and this one's jumping on. The thing with this movie, though, is the story is about they live in this area of Miami, I think they live in a bar. I'm not sure. It's,
well,
there's
part
a bar
three,
that
they
always
lived in a warehouse.
Yeah, everyone has a warehouse, and it's huge.
There's
and it's
warehouses filled with, that are really trendy.
And that's where it's a warehouse, and they work. And then there's a bar. Yeah. It's a Cuban guy who owns this bar, and that's what they do. And what they're doing is they're trying to win a YouTube contest to whoever can get the most hits. If you get 10, the first one to 10 million, you know, wins $10 million. And they're keep talking
about
how
poor they... Can I take a guess? Is it because some greedy developers are trying to buy
their
warehouse area
not
in order
just
to build
any...
a mall? What is it? Are they going to build a mall? Or
no, they're going to build a luxury hotel. But
oh,
not only that,
I was so close.
The daughter of the developer is, of course...
Well, obviously. You can't have... The beauty, the thing that like got me so excited when I saw the Step Up trailer was that within the 2-minute trailer, they clearly told you, okay, we got dancing... This is a Save the Rec Center movie and a Wrong Side of the Tracks love story.
Absolutely.
Like, there's nothing else. Don't worry. We got the two things you go to the movies to see covered. And Peter Gallagher's in it. So for those
Peter
people,
but you know what's depressing about it is they toned down his eyebrows. Maybe his eyebrows were too intense for 3D. Because I was expecting him to kind of like turn around and have a go and have his eyebrows like fly over right over the audience or something like that.
Why is my nose itching? Oh God, I got Peter Gallagher's eyebrow in there.
Ooh, nasty. But anyways, the thing is, like all the other Step Up movies, I mean, like 2 and 3. I mean, like 2 took place in a school.
Here's the weird thing about 2. If you really
2 was in a school.
2 right? is about a girl, a white girl who's kind of like an orphan who, you know, because life is so hard.
Who wants to be black.
What's that?
She wants to be black.
No,
right?
She wants to be black. And so she's with like, she hangs out with this black dance troupe. But then because fate hates her so much, she loses a bet with Channing Tatum and has to go to this fancy rich academy. Oh my God, your life is so hard. You're now going to private school. And at private school, she starts dancing. And then it turns out her black dance group kicks her out. And so her and the rich kids start a dance troupe. And they want to compete at the titular streets, the streets of the dance competition.
Yeah.
And so it's like her, the Asian kid, the Jewish kid, like all of these kind of model minorities are like, we want to win the streets. It's like, wait, you kids are rich. You go to a rich private school. And now you need to take this away from like the street kids.
We need to win the money. Well, but isn't the third one? They also, it's a big dance competition. This is the big difference in these movies. Is this one? It's not a dance competition because
it's like a telethon, right? It's like breaking.
No. It's because the second one they're going to the streets, and the third one it's not the streets, but it's another.
It's
type
a big
of
competition. Yeah, it's like Karate Kid of dance.
Yeah, only this one, it's them doing protest art. So what they do is it's called the mob, and they go into flash mob mm-hmm. things all over the place, and then they realize they're trying to make a statement. Yeah, and they're trying to win the YouTube thing. This is the best funded group of poor kids you have ever seen, and they show the guy who's. Because the whole thing is they find ways to get into places and cause these big commotional flash mobs. So this guy's in this hat. They have one of them who's their hacker. It's kind of like an episode of Leverage. You know, and so the guy's got the hacker. And he's got 17 computers and desktops and laptops and 40-inch high-def screens all around.
They just throw those things away in Miami. You know,
where the hell did... And it's just in the warehouse, too. And then when they do their things, they're have costuming. And there's literally a scene where they're throwing money. And I couldn't tell whether it was real money or not. Because this is one of my favorite things in bad movies are terrible extras. Extras who have no business. There's a reason why there are in Hollywood professional extras. People who do nothing but play in background. Because there's a special art to it. You need to fill the background, but you can't draw attention to yourself. These people draw attention to themselves.
But this could be your moment to shine.
All the goddamn time. Because the whole thing is they're throwing money down on them during this corporate thing. And they're all wearing these suits. They look like they're from the Adjustment Bureau.
Oh, God. It's like Cocktail in a way.
But it's so funny. And then at the end, as they're watching, these people are grabbing the money out of their hair. And they're the extras are like, ooh. And I'm like, wait, are those really $100 bills? Why are they competing for $10 million? What are they throwing money?
Literally throwing money away.
Literally throwing it away. And nobody goes for it except these three extras that are grabbing it and just acting completely out of control. But then they infiltrate.
And throwing their headshots while they're at it.
Well, then they infiltrate an art installation mm-hmm. and they do a big dance. And I mean, just watching this going, the logistics alone
to break into security
is and they hack in the security and they get everybody they have one guy being a waiter there and one person being the girl gets a job as the DJ and they're like we can't trace
every step up move is a heist.
It's insane. It is the worst one though, the one that's a little bit unnerving. There's literally seen at this gala that they're at. And what happens? How they break in? Suddenly they fuzz out the video screens that they're doing a presentation on. They throw smoke bombs.
Oh, no.
And I'm watching and go, what? And they show up in gas masks. And I'm like, this is the worst time to release this movie ever. I'm like, I can't believe that. I mean, it's not like they knew.
Sure,
but I mean, if Warner Brothers is recutting Gangster Squad.
Like the entire movie.
The actual movie. They're reshooting that scene. It's jarring. It's kind of like back in 2001 when you'd see the Twin Towers in something.
Like just in Zoolander and it was
controversial. Yeah, just in the background. Yeah. So
what
it's
if Step Up 4 jarring. Becomes the most controversial film of the year?
It could
what
be.
What if it happens? It might happen.
It could happen. But so that's...
It is
that's
about a revolution.
And I'm watching this thing going, they're so organized. But the other thing is they're infiltrating these things and I'm like... I know they're just
dancing. Couldn't one of them
dancing,
hack into the U.S. Treasury and just steal the funds that they need?
What if they really suddenly just went off? What if just somebody something broke in their mind and they decided to be terrorists? They obviously have the means to do
that. Let's face it, though. If we're gonna have terrorists in this world, wouldn't you want them to be step up dancers?
They're dancerists, I guess.
They're dancerists.
And there's one character who, whenever they do a flash mob. He always does some sort of street art. And there's one scene where the opening sequence, which you've seen in the trailer with the cars bouncing and everything.
Yeah.
He pulls out three full sheets of glass, secures them on this platform and then does this 3D spray paint art. I'm like, this thing's 3 minutes long. How the heck did you get that accomplished? I mean, you street artists don't just do these full wall murals. They don't do that in 5 minutes.
Well, some of them, that's their thing.
That quickly? I mean, this isn't stenciling.
Sped up the editing.
This isn't Banksy stenciling something really quickly or driving, doing it in his shop and then running his car out and then dropping it in the middle of London and driving away.
If Banksy mated with one of the step-up dancers and produced a child... That child will rule us all, and I will be happy to live in that world.
You totally would. Nobody would show their face.
No. And they would all dance.
The other thing is that they're all the most conspicuous people ever, and they show their faces, and they put them on YouTube, and then there's TV, the news is who's the mob? And I'm like, you have pictures of them, you have pictures of their cars, the most obvious big, huge gangster ball in cars, and nobody takes
this, and then have issues with Batman and the fact that somebody figured out he was Bruce Wayne.
Well, that was ridiculous.
Really?
Anyways, Step Up Revolution,
it rocks. You know it. It must rock. I haven't seen it, and I know it.
It kind of rocks for what it is, but it's not a good movie.
And that's the thing about that why I will defend these movies to the death. Not part one. I will never defend part one.
Yes.
But I will defend 2, 3, and probably 4. Yeah. Whenever, you know, and again, this is, I love film, and I understand there's a lot of films I hate, sure. But when a film is good at what it is, you have to give it credit for that.
No, it's great for those parts. It's just, it's the stuff in the middle that's... It's that connective tissue. That's my new thing.
That's the part where you just look at the person next to you and you're like, wait, did they really just say that? Am I understanding? Did I miss something?
Is there a reason why
this guy's German and his sister is American? I don't know.
Here's the biggest offense of this movie, and this may actually make you change your tune. There are like literally 3 times in this movie where they could have had them say, no, you have to do something. You have to step up. And they do not say the name of the movie.
Oh, damn it.
And shame on them for not doing that, because that's like the best part. That was the best part of Savages, was when they said Savages like 18 times in the movie. I was so excited.
Maybe I'll just have to go to like a midnight screening drunk and say it myself at times.
I don't know why this is a maybe.
I wanted to see Battleship in the theaters. And nobody, and I'm not kidding when I say nobody would see it with me.
It's so
stupid. The reason I really wanted to see it was I really wanted to get to hear them say, you suck my Battleship.
They don't say it though.
And that's the thing. And if they didn't say it and I knew and I figured that out at a certain point, I would be the one in the theater to say it.
Yeah, well, and in the worst part, first of all, they knew she'd sink a battleship, so they could have said it. Second of all, do you know what the big catch line is? You know, the Hasta La Vista baby
game
line
over?
Is?
Is it game over?
No, she goes, mahalo, motherfucker, and they cut out, because this has to be
PG-13,
because it's in Hawaii. The thing is, though, mahalo, that line makes no sense, because she's ready to blow
him up. Hello and goodbye, motherfucker.
No, yeah, it's, mahalo means thank you.
I mean, thank you, but that's right.
Thank you, motherfucker. And what? That makes no goddamn sense. Yeah, thank you, come again. But no, it's...
I'm convinced the director's cut of Battleship will clear up any problems with it.
It's so funny, because what she should say aloha, motherfucker. But I guarantee you there was a big discussion about this line, because somebody probably said, no, mahalo sounds better. It sounds better as a line. Makes no goddamn sense. But they had, so it should be aloha. It's like, well, aloha would sound too cheesy. I guarantee you there was probably
a debate. And they probably tried
both
of them out with test audiences.
Yes, and people are like, yeah, mahalo, motherfuckers. Like, you guys have no goddamn mind. It is not like mahalo. I mean, it's not necessarily general knowledge, but anyone who's been to Hawaii knows.
Right.
In McDonald's, you know how they say thank you
mm-hmm.
on the trash, the little swinging
right,
things, or like AMC Theater,
yeah.
Thank you, feed me, or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
It says mahalo in the... mahalo is all over the place in Hawaii. So it'd be like, oh, dandruff, motherfucker.
iPhone, motherfucker.
Yeah, I mean, just so terrible.
See, I just wanted, because I was, when I saw the trailer for it, I just could not believe how blatantly pandering it was. How it was like, okay, so yeah, we bought the property to Battleship, and we heard that, so we have to, we're on a Battleship, but we heard that robots are really big. But then District 9 did really well a few years ago, so we think that aliens are still in. So then we decided we would just combine the two and make it about aliens versus robots. And I have, no, granted, I haven't seen it, so I'm also assuming there's vampires in there at some point.
There should be.
I just can't wait to sit down and watch Liam Neeson deliver a performance in Battleship. I think when it comes out, I'm going to buy it on Blu-ray and have a party.
And get drunk.
I need to watch it drunk with other people, and I want us all to appreciate the fact that it just has to be good, right? It has to be.
It's not. No. There's no has to be. That you're thinking. You're overthinking.
But like
this.
I'm somebody who recently sought out Kazam to watch. So
Kazam.
I'm thinking I'm going to like this movie.
Yeah, well, it's a bad movie. It's going to be one that people will remember. It's sort of like the line from Raiders of the Lost Ark where Bellick says, you know, take a look at this worthless $10 watch I got. You buried in the desert for 1,000 years, it'll be priceless. That's, I think, the way Battleship's going to be. You have to bury it in the sand, though,
mm-hmm.
for it to then emerge priceless. So
I could see that. It's going to be a time capsule.
Oh, yeah. So anyways,
of everything studios thought people wanted in 2012.
I know. It'd be like, what? People were crazy back then.
CGI aliens? What?
The best part about Battleship, there was an article written in Vulture where it compiles the entirety of Rihanna's dialogue, which is, I think, 218 words. I mean, it's literally shorter than most reviews of the movie. the entirety of her dialogue. And it's worth finding and reading because it is like spending time in the mind of an insane person.
Nice.
So yeah, definitely go check that out. Now the next thing I want to talk about, I want to make a, we'll talk a little bit real quick about The Dark Knight Rises. Just a note, we're not talking about the shootings. We're not going to talk about the Aurora stuff. If you want to hear what I had to say about that, go listen to The Idiot Boxers. I don't want to, you know, bring this down. Let's talk about the movie. Let's focus on the film. No disrespect to the victims, but that has nothing to do with
that. Yeah, that's a hefty topic to tackle after Step Up Revolution.
I know. You know, how can you handle that? But anyways, you saw it. Did you like it?
I liked it. I don't know yet how I feel about it overall in terms of the three.
Yeah.
I had problems with it, but most of my problems were, a lot of them were resolved by that last chunk.
Really?
Because I was not feeling it for that first hour. I was worried. And then once things kind of started coming together, I was like, okay, I'm in it now. And it was also really tense for me because I saw it on Sunday and I like the other two Nolan. I'm a Nolan fan. I like the other two films. I've never cared that much about Batman, but my boyfriend is one of those people who like was personally offended by the Joel Schumacher films. Like the kind of guy who's just sees this as something very sacred. So going to see the movie with him was just really tense for me. Because the entire film, I just like...
You're like an abused wife, afraid. You're like, don't hurt me.
Like,
don't
please, please be good for him, please. Yeah. And it really did, like, I have never wanted a movie to be so good because somebody else was going to care about it. And it wasn't, like, if the movie was okay, I didn't really care. I'm like, no matter what happens, I might have issues, but I'm probably going to be entertained. But like, if it was bad, I don't know. I don't know that I would be dead, but some, you know, Christopher Nolan would have to answer to someone that's not me.
Okay.
So it was a tense film watching experience just because there was a lot of energy going on.
Yeah.
But overall, I don't know how much I can say because I don't know where would do we want to.
I don't want to do too many spoilers. I mean, I still want to keep it relatively spoiler free because I know that. Even though a lot of people saw it this week, there's still going to be half the people.
Okay.
The way movies run, half the people who are going to see it that first weekend, and then the other half see it over the course of
Time. Well, yeah, and I think it's going to, considering how many shows were sold out, a lot of people are still haven't gotten to see it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I won't spoil anything. Things I liked, I actually really liked Anne Hathaway. I liked what they did with Catwoman, or Selena, if you want to say. I liked the Joseph Gordon-Levitt storyline. I always love Gary Oldman as Gordon, and I was very surprised. I actually teared up at a certain Gordon moment that just was, I thought was very touching. There's some things I can't say, so I won't. But I think it solved some of the problems the other films have had.
Okay.
It has a lot of flaws, and I think, like we were saying earlier, if you hold a microscope to it, there's a lot of frays in the seams.
I think the difference between this, Nolan's, the other two films, Batman Begins to a lesser degree, because I think that has some, it has still some remnants of, well, we have to have the studio, we got to have goofy lines and stuff like that. You know, lighten up, Batman, throw a lighter at him kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I thought they both flowed well.
This one I actually thought, and I know this was the longest one, and I'm somebody that does get annoyed by movies that feel too long, but I actually was never bored. I was a little bored in the beginning and in kind of a, where's this going way? But this movie didn't feel overlong to me. Now, I'm in the minority on this, but I feel like Dark Knight has pacing and length issues.
See, I just recently watched it, and I think the Dark Knight moves through. I never felt like I was looking at my watch. Same thing with Inception, even though I think Inception has serious problems. Inception does not feel like it's as long as it is. This one, it felt 2 hours and 45 minutes. But what I was going to say is the other movies that Nolan has done, and I think there's a lot of problems with The Dark Knight, and everyone on Monday wrote, all these blogs wrote articles, the 10 worst problems with The Dark Knight. Here's my issues with The Dark Knight. So everybody like jumped people's shit for dissing it, and
before
then
they
suddenly then turned
it
around on Monday and then wrote shit about dissing it. And almost everything in there can be kind of shaken off and forgiven and being like, it's a superhero movie. Because let's face it, you got to be a little bit lenient on superhero films. But I think that Nolan has, with his other two films, has kind of been raised to a higher standard. So I just don't like the fact that you have to use those excuses for his films.
Fair enough. It's not perfect. Yeah. I think he's made better films. I don't think this is his best film. You don't like The Prestige, right?
I'm not a big fan. It's not, I didn't hate it.
Yes. That's my favorite of his, and I think that's
All of his movies I like. Mm-hmm. I've not disliked any of his movies. Probably my least favorite is Insomnia, but I like it. It's just I don't think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, with this, I don't know yet if it's a great movie. It may be one of those great in terms of spirit and attitude, but technically it's going to be hard to say it's great because, I mean, I got a couple problems from it.
The more I think about it, the less I like it. But I'm going to go check it out again. I do want to see it because I didn't get to see it at IMAX.
I'm going to check it out again in a few years, I think, which is what I did with Batman Begins and Dark Knight. Yeah. And both of them, to me, some problems kind of popped out on second viewing, but overall, I like both of the films more the second time around.
Yeah.
Batman Begins, I really enjoyed watching the first time I saw it. I just thought, wow, this is so different for a Batman film and, you know. But rewatching it, I still think Batman Begins is a really strong film. Yeah. Dark Knight, oddly enough, where I lose interest is during one of the big action sequences that just kind of... Because Dark Knight, after that first big, you know, the heist, you get mostly dialogue and you have mostly, you know, just kind of drama going on. And then by the time you get to that big chase with the Joker and Batman on the motorcycle... Or the bat cycle, whatever you call it.
The bat pod.
Don't hate me, fan people. Once you get to that scene to me I was shocked when I watched the movie the second time. I'm like, I'm suddenly bored. This scene is going on too long. I want to get back to the story. I want to get back to Harvey Dent and, I don't need to, the Joker isn't the action guy. I don't need to see the action. I'd rather just be watching kind of what he's doing.
Yeah. No, we'll disagree on that one. Mm-hmm. But the thing I wanted to bring up with The Dark Knight, and this is something this is one of my problems, and a lot of people's problems with the movie, is Bane's voice. And a lot of people have pointed this out, and very fairly so, because I heard somebody say on Twitter, he sounds like a cartoon walrus. And they're
like
absolutely right.
He's great aunt.
He does sound like a cartoon walrus. I'm Bane. Hello. So everyone's pointing this out. So me pointing out Bane's voice is not a unique thing. But I think something that I don't think people are pointing out, I think needs to be pointed out. And even when I mentioned it last week to Brian Salisbury, who was my guest host last week, and I complained about Bane's voice, he's like, that's totally Warner Brothers' fault. And of course, the reason Bane's voice was changed from what it originally was, because when they dropped that first trailer, some people had complained, a lot of people complained, that they couldn't understand what Bane was saying in the trailer. Even though I could understand it, those lines, even if you could understand them, those were said pretty much without any ambient noise. There weren't explosions. There wasn't anything else going on. And it's sort of like in Tron Legacy, the scenes of young Jeff Bridges in Tron Legacy looked great. When you got to the full film, that's when some of them were in the Uncanny Valley. And what they did is they said, well, if we're going to put it in the trailer, let's make those shots look as good as possible. And so those scenes in the trailer are arguably the most clearly Bane speaks. Those are his clearest lines. And if people are having trouble hearing those, they would have had real trouble hearing the other ones. So yes, Warner Brothers came in and basically probably said to Nolan, look, you got to fix this. You have to make Bane more intelligible. And yes, that's Warner Brothers' fault for telling him he has to do that. And yes, that's true. But that's their prerogative, because they put $200 million in this movie and they'd be like, dude, seriously.
I mean, I know because even the movie being as it was, there were times I couldn't understand them.
He was hard to understand in some scenes too.
Yeah, I mean, especially when he's already like, and then he has a microphone near his mouth.
Yeah.
If you've ever heard somebody who has a bad speaking voice then speak in a microphone, it's even worse.
But here's the thing. It's not just Warner Brothers' fault. It is Nolan's fault. It's Nolan's fault
150%. I mean, he should have found a better way around it.
That's my point.
Yeah.
He has... this, he's like, it was Warner Brothers' fault that said, I'm sorry, you need to make this more intelligible. What he settled on is his own fucking fault because it's a terrible voice. He, and you can't sit there and be like, oh, they took it away from him and forced it. No. Christopher right, Nolan. He did Batman.
Probably found a better way of doing
it. The Dark Knight was one of the biggest hits in the world ever of all time. You know, Inception did incredibly well. This guy was not like under the yoke of a studio and having to change things. Like, well, I think in Batman Begins, he was bowing to the request of the studio at times.
Had a little less input.
But this one, I mean, he had full control over what the fuck, and that's the best he could come up with. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. It's like the other one, and it just, maybe it's just that Nolan is terrible at picking voices. Because
I mean,
I've always had
a problem with the Batman voice. I've watched the movies, I don't, because what I realized was it changes from Batman Begins to Dark Knight, which I think makes sense. Because it makes sense that in Batman Begins, he'd be kind of learning that, oh, I need to have a different voice. This is what I'm going to go with. And then by Dark Knight, he's been doing this a couple of years, so now he's full into
Batman. Well, but even all the time, he talks like this through everything.
When he's Batman.
But here's the thing. Again, that's Nolan's fault. And I got in this argument with Brian Salisbury last week, where he's like,
a lot of
Brian was very argumentative on me. He's like, well, you can't sound just like Bruce Wayne. I go, you can come up with something better. I'll give you two examples on both these fronts where have been better alternatives. If you go back to the 1989 Batman that Tim Burton did, Michael Keaton talked in a heavier, he changed his voice as Batman. And it sounded okay, but he didn't sound ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like it's something that he could continue to talk. I talk like this for 5 minutes and my throat kills me. This guy's
Bale
a billionaire. Put a modulator on his voice, just talking a lower register, whatever. So obviously you can do it. Maybe it's because Christian Bale couldn't do a voice very well. Maybe he could.
Maybe he couldn't develop it.
Yeah, well. But here's the thing with Bane. You say, well, that's the best we could do. I'm like, what about Star Wars? I mean, you got Darth Vader, who literally has a complete breath mask on, is breathing through. You hear the breathing the whole time, and they put in a voice. Never once have I ever heard anyone say, the Darth Vader voice sounds so stupid.
Or I couldn't understand him, yeah.
Yeah, you knew everything he said.
And that is the thing, yeah. I still couldn't understand him at times.
Yeah. But I mean, like,
Sean Connery-ish.
Yeah. There's a scene, I said this last week. There's a scene in Batman Forever where Jim Carrey as the Riddler.
I'm sorry.
He goes, Batman? Batman! Sounds exactly like Batman. Batman? So my point is, it is Nolan's fault. He does not get a pass for this. I'm sorry. He made a terrible decision. He had to change it, and then he changed it. He edited, sound mixed, mastered an entire movie, did screenings and all that shit, and never once did he go, that was not... And it's not even like he's come out in the press and been like, guys, I know Bane has a goofy-ass voice. It's the best I could do, really, seriously. I know it's silly. I cringe now, so please forgive me. No, this was his approval. And so, yes, it's sort of like... I compare it to Alien 3.
Okay.
Where Fincher... If you tell people I don't like Alien 3 and I don't think Fincher did a good job, Fincher fans lose their shit all over the place, because Fincher fans and Nolan fans are very similar, because they will just grab that giant dick and be just like, oh no, 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 anything, no, he it's okay, it's if it's even if it's terrible,
it tastes
even
really
if it's
good,
bad, no, I like it, thank you. Anything, they can do no wrong. So the fans are they apologize for everything. So.
Well, the thing sorry the, for the giant blowjob about Alien 3, and I'm not an official.
Well, let me say my point about Alien 3.
Okay,
people, when you bring up the problems with Alien 3, they go, "Well, it's not Fincher's fault; it's Fox's fault because they were meddling and blah 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 blah." And I'm like, Fincher was a brand new director who was only known through music videos, and if you read some of the ideas, there were some possible good ideas elsewhere, but what they ended up with wasn't good from conception stage. Whereas like Alien Resurrection was a failure of a movie, but it had some neat ideas that just weren't executed right. This one just it's the same old for this. But the thing is, if Fincher is a brand new director, he didn't know to play ball. You can't, it's his fault for not playing ball. He's a brand new director. It's his first chance. You know how the business works. If you then cause problems and be like, well, the studio's causing, and now Fincher has that power now, but back then he didn't. So it is his fault for not playing ball.
But it's also, if he had played ball harder, he probably would have been fired from the film. That's happened plenty of times. It will happen with my DVD pick of the week, actually, once we get there.
What do you mean? If you play ball harder?
If he
fought harder.
If he fought harder, he, you know, if he really was intent about, I'm not changing this, I'm not doing this.
Well, yeah, he would have been fired.
Studio could have turned around and said, okay, well, you know, there's this Brett Ratner kid who wants to direct a movie. Let's hire him.
Yeah, but no, my point is that it's sort of like Fincher. He didn't get what he wanted, and the studio was causing. It's like, okay, I'll do it as a gun for hire, and then he kind of does a shoddy job on it, sort of the way Raimi did with.
But we also have never really Spider-Man seen, 3. I think, his complete Alien 3.
You see it as complete as you can get.
But we've never seen, I don't think, even from what I understand, the like Blu-ray special edition release.
I've watched both versions. They're the same.
But is it his director's cut or is it just quote unquote special edition?
I don't know.
Because I don't think he was involved with
I don't care. You're given this thing and you say, make this movie like this. And he didn't, I don't think he did a good job in it. I don't think his heart was in it because he was a whiny little bitch and didn't get his way and then whined about it. That's my opinion of Fincher.
He probably was all of those things. He kind of looks like a whiner.
He's a whiny little bitch.
Yeah.
And now he has the ability to do what he wants to. And that's because he's kind of built a respectable career. But you don't get your first job and then be like, the studio didn't do what I wanted and I want to do this. So I'm just going to do a shitty job. Now that'll show him. Which is sort of feels like what Alien 3 turned into. And that's what I felt that Nolan did with the voice of Bane. He's just like, well, fuck them. I'll just do a stupid, goofy-ass walrus voice.
Scottish.
You gotta speak like this. Hello, I'm Bane.
Higher pitch, though. It's a weird high pitch for a big man.
What's funny is when he first talks in the plane.
Yeah.
I'm like,
well, then I couldn't understand a word Bane? He said in the plane.
But I mean, like, when he said it, I'm like, it was just the word. You know, it's like, I saw, there's the whole thing of, like, the introduction of a character is very important in a movie. You know, great examples, Darth Vader in Star Wars coming through the smoke. The Joker in Dark Knight. That was fantastic. Or, you know, Indiana Jones when he first walks out and he walks into the light. I mean, these are great introductions of characters. And what's Bane? Ray, what's going on? And I'm like, what old man is stuck on the plane? I expected something. Was this the play that was going to the best exotic Marigold Hotel?
Crossover.
Hello. So, anywho, that's my point about The Dark Knight. Do you have anything else to say before we talk real quick about box office?
No, I guess not.
Okay. Well, box office winners, of course, as we spoke earlier, the best exotic Marigold Hotel came from behind and won the weekend.
I mean, that Judi Dench, I tell you, she's got star power.
And she didn't even show her tits. Amazing. But no, Dark Knight Rises won with $160 million, which, first of all...
Isn't that about as good as you can get? That's
perfectly acceptable. It didn't have a 3D bump. It had IMAX bumps.
I wonder if anybody has calculated what the maximum amount of a movie that is in 2D can make in a weekend.
Yeah.
Every showing of Dark Knight that I tried to get tickets to was sold out.
Well, you live in New York, too.
Yeah, but I mean, if anything, there's more theaters in New York.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is here there are plenty of non-sold out screenings.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, during, you know, Sunday morning. I mean, I'm sure there are people there, but I don't know. The thing is, $160 million is perfectly acceptable. When people were saying, is it going to beat Avengers? No, it wasn't. Well, it was never going to beat Avengers.
Because it's not $25 for a ticket.
Yeah. But contrary to what that awful, horrible shit stain of a person, Nikki Fink, says, I don't think the shooting in Colorado had any impact on the box office. I mean, there are stupid people who are like my mom came over. We celebrated.
You're calling your mom stupid?
Party. Yes, because this is what happened. I took one of my sons, my middle son Ben. I took him to see it, and we were celebrating his birthday party on Monday night, and so the family was over, and my mom mentioned Batman. And he's like, oh, I saw Dark Knight, and she's like, well, what'd you do? Did you go see a midnight movie and midnight show with your dad? And he goes, no, I saw it at the press screening. My mom's like, good. I'm like, there was one theater out of thousands. Mm-hmm. And in one theater, there was one actual movie house. And it was quite literally an isolated incident. Yes. So
my mother gave me a similar, you're going to the movies?
You're going to the movies? Yeah. It's like, I think if there would have been like 10 incidents across the country at midnight.
Right.
All
then
coordinated.
It would have, yeah.
Yeah. That would have, people would have been like, yeah, I'm not going in. But, you know, so I mean, it's, I don't think it had any impact on it, which is good because it has nothing to do with that movie.
Yeah. No, this is, yeah, very isolated.
But 160 million, which it tops The Dark Knight. And it's a very, very respectable opening. I don't think it's going to score as much as The Dark Knight. I think it's going to have, it's going to be much more front loaded.
Well, it's a tough one though, because I think a lot
I don't
of,
think,
it's going to have a real, this week is, it's going to take this weekend without question. Well, I mean, unless Step Up 4, unless people finally learn the truth. But it could have, this weekend could be, it won't be obviously 160 million, but I think this weekend could be huge because you have a lot of people who couldn't see it this weekend because it was sold out.
I don't know.
You know, a lot of people might even have waited a week to go to a non-crowded theater.
I think you're going to see the same pattern as a Twilight movie on this. I know people are going to be pissed off for hearing that. I think you're going to see the half the money being made on those first 3 days, mm-hmm. if you include midnight shows. So 160 million, I think this is going to top out just over 300 million when all said and done.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like next weekend, so it made what, like something like 25 on midnight, which isn't as much as like Harry Potter made, but I think it's going to,
because it's 2D.
Well, but still, 43 million, I think, was what Harry Potter made, which is the highest for midnights. But so if you take that, so if you take 25 off of that, it's 135 million. So it'll probably make about 70 million this weekend. So it'll be half of that, and mm-hmm. then it'll be half of that after that. I don't think you're going to, part of the thing with The Dark Knight, the one from 2008, is that it was, it had that word of mouth. There are a lot of people who yeah. saw the movie and then went home and were like, oh my God, you got to go see right. this. I don't hear people saying that. You hear some rabid fanboy saying that.
True. I think you have more of the people who are going to see this one are going to see it because they saw The Dark Knight versus, oh, my friends really said I have to see this movie.
Yeah.
I think at this point it's because you're invested in it that you're going to go see it.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to have still people going and, you know, telling people through August. And I think that's what happened with the Avengers, which is why it made 200 and some million, and then another 400 million over the summer, is that people saw it that first weekend and loved it, and then went home and told people, no, you really should see this movie. It's a good movie. And then you had
people, then they rewatched the other movies and said, okay, now I'll go see it.
Word of mouth really mm-hmm. worked on that one. I think it's good for in the 60s. I just don't see it making much more than that. And it might, who knows? But I don't think it will.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have huge competition. I mean, this weekend, obviously, there's nothing challenging it. Next weekend is Total Recall, which I think in cope bombs.
In what?
Wait,
what did you say? You think in what?
And hope it bombs.
Oh, you hope it bombs. I'm kind of looking forward to it.
I don't know. I mean, I should hold my tongue until I see it, because who knows? Maybe it's great. I adore the original film. And I think it's fine to remake it, because the premise is so great. And I think you could totally take it in a different direction. But it's the guy who did, it's Len Wiseman, right? Who did, who just doesn't seem like he's, and based on the trailers, it doesn't feel like they're giving it anything new. It just looks like another underworld movie.
I'm kind of looking forward to it. I don't know. I want to see it. We'll find out next week.
I'm curious to hear your take on it.
But I think there's other, you got The Watch. I don't know if The Watch is going to pull anybody away from
The
Dark Knight.
The Watch could, about all the, what's counter programming versus what is going to get its audience. Like Step Up 4 is going to have a very different audience.
I don't think though this has anything to do with competition. I think this has to do with people's desire to go see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, what's going to slow The Dark Knight Rises down, is that most of the people who are dying to see it have already seen it.
And then you're going to have people who are like, oh, I want to go to the movies. Do I want to sit down for a 3 hour dark Batman movie?
Yeah.
Or do I want to watch Ben Stiller shoot an alien?
Well, but the other thing is, this is where I use the example of the Twilight movies. The first Twilight movie did well its first weekend, but it had all these people then going and telling their girlfriends, because it was, let's face it, that's who saw it.
No, it was, you mean their middle-aged and mother friends.
Yeah, their little mother, well, girlfriends in the general sense.
And their moms.
Then it was built by word of mouth, and whatever its opening weekend was, it did better. You know,
yeah,
did more than
that. Yeah, a film that built.
All the other sequels have been extremely front-loaded. And even that first Breaking Dawn, most of them at least made twice what their opening weekend. Breaking Dawn made more than half its money in those first 3 days. And I think The Dark Knight Rises isn't going to be as much like that, but I think that's the pattern it's going to follow, as opposed to the Dark Knight, or even so I think Everyone who wants to see it, really, really wants to see it, have already seen it. And there are going to be other people seeing it. Because even though I know people like Fozzie, who we talked about, you know, Fozzie Bear, He went like on Sunday.
I went on Sunday.
But I know that there were people who were packed. From a friend, Leonard, who was on several months ago, he lives in the Bronx, and he went to one of the big theaters and at like 10 in the morning on Sunday or Saturday, and it was packed.
I went Sunday morning at 12:50 to the AMC, Which is one of the biggest theaters in there. And we got, the movie started at 12:50. We got into the theater at like 12:42, and there were about five, even though we had pre-ordered our tickets, but There were like five seats left at that point.
So anyways, that's what I think is going to happen. Now, next thing, we're going to move on and talk about we have a question again from Thomas from Seattle. And this is very appropriate because we talked about Battleship early. And his question is, Taylor Kitsch has had a pretty bad year, making a bumpy transition into his movie career. I think he was great in Friday Night Lights, but can you think of any example of people who've started their movie careers as poorly as Kitsch has and someone somehow found their way to recover? Honestly, I've been thinking about this. I really can't.
I thought of one that came to mind, of somebody who started in a very big flop, and it was a very famous flop, and that would be Jessica Lange in King Kong.
Okay.
It's definitely a different case, because it wasn't like she was in five really bad movies.
See, I think
she wasn't a really high-profile film and was considered, even though if you watch it now, I actually think she's fine in it. But when it came
she's not the problem in King Kong.
But I think a lot of the blame was put on her for whatever reason, because it was easy to do. And I mean, obviously,
because she's a woman, and we know that they're not as smart as men.
Oh, that's true.
It's science. You can't. Ron Burgundy has quoted it. Science.
I'm trying to think of others. Were there any SNL actors, come to think of it, who had that kind of experience?
Well, I think there are plenty of people. I think there are plenty of people who have done weak beginnings of movies, where their first couple movies just didn't do well, and then suddenly they blew
up. Like we were talking earlier, like James Franco and Channing Tatum, in a way, kind of had similar paths in that way.
Yeah,
just uneventful. You wouldn't think twice about them, and then suddenly they got on a roll and did films that really appealed to people.
Yeah, and you also have ones where people like have come on strong and then have a slump. Angelina Jolie was like that. Her first couple movies were kind of, she ramped up there, and then she had this surge of nothingness, just bomb after bomb.
But she was somehow still famous enough on her own that,
and she made so much. She was committed to so many movies.
People didn't think of her as box office poison, even though she was.
Yeah, or like Jennifer Aniston, but Jennifer Aniston never had those hits. The difference with Taylor Kitsch, I can think of somebody who did it and didn't recover is Dane Cook.
Yeah, David Caruso too, even.
He was there, or like Dane Cook had this. But the reason I say Dane Cook is because he had like this period of time in about a year or two where he had boom, 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 like three or four movies, and none of them did very well. And he but then they just stopped making movies. And his the guy he was in, who's the guy, the chubby guy? He was in Good Luck Chuck with him, I think. He was in Balls of Fury. I can't remember his name. Dan Fogler.
He was on Broadway.
Yeah, Dan Fogler, another one where he was suddenly cast in everything, and then he disappeared. And then there's other ones like Jude Law got, some people like Jude Law will get overexposed, and he had movies that just didn't do well, like Alfie didn't do well. But the difference with Taylor Kitsch is he had that 1-2 punch of two movies that by the numbers should have been huge, and both were considered big flops.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, he then comes out with Savages, which isn't doing well, but I mean, it's
like people
not,
are kind of letting him off the hook for it.
They're kind of
like,
off the hook.
It's Oliver Stone film. It wasn't going to drive in
we knew it wasn't going to do well. But it's like not doing his career any good. And before this, his only other like movie role, he was like in X-Men Wolverine as Gambit for like 10 minutes. So I think his is a very unique case where you have, again, another one I can think of who suddenly came on, who was in a bunch of movies and they all kind of bombed and they're somewhat high profile, was Dina Meyer. She was in like Dragonheart, and she was in Starship Troopers, and she was in Johnny Mnemonic.
She is always the best thing in really bad movies.
Yeah, but
even
but
Saw,
she never...
she's actually really good in the Saw films. Yeah, and she gets her stomach ripped out.
But then she, but the thing is, she never then turned.
She's
she
always
never
been
turned
a
her career
actress,
around.
Yeah.
Yeah, she never suddenly like stumbled into something and it made her super huge. You know, I think people kind of come out of obscurity, but I mean, I don't, I can't think of anyone else who
like
who
Anna
was...
Faris kind of started doing really bad movies, but she still does bad movies. She's just now people recognize that she's.
But she's not like you with... don't like. I mean, she has. She hasn't been in as. I think the difference with Kitsch is. He was in two
it was, they were so
huge
high profile.
Movies. And again, by the numbers, if you would have looked in this in January, you said these should have been the most two of the highest grossing movies, and they weren't. And by and large, they can be partly tied to his performance. Because I thought he gave a very flat John Carter, even though I liked the movie. And in Battleship, he gave you nothing to attach yourself to.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think so, actually. I think I'd have to say to Thomas from Seattle that he's actually a unique, he is a unique bomb in Hollywood.
It makes him special in his own way.
Special, yes. We'll stroke his
he's
head.
He's still a good looking guy. I'm sure his ego is doing fine in other ways.
Oh, I'm sure.
He's banging supermodels.
Yeah, they may have orgasms. He's having wargasms.
Aww.
Swear to God, that's a line from Savages.
Oh God, is it really?
Oh my God. And to top it off, it's actually said by Blake Lively, which makes it even more terrible.
Pretty girl, very pretty girl. Not a lot of talent there.
No, not even
great
a little
hair.
Talent.
She's got beautiful hair.
She's beautiful, but it ends there.
If I was casting a movie, well, wasn't she replaced Jennifer Lawrence, didn't she?
Did she?
It was supposed to be Jennifer Lawrence had that role and dropped out to do the Hunger Games. So
who made the better
know,
decision on that one?
Which I like imagining now every Jennifer Lawrence performance being replaced by Blake Lively.
Oh my
like,
God.
Like picture Blake
awesome.
Lively in Winter's Bone. And like doing a Southern accent, like wearing the wolf shirt. It just wouldn't work.
Oh, that would be awesome.
But it's really fun to imagine.
Let's move on to the Fat Guy 5. This is in honor of Step Up Revolution.
It's a bit of a, how do we call it? This is an intense Fat Guy 5.
I think this is good. We had some arguments about this. But here's what it is. Actually, I'm going to make sure that you have the proper order of these. But the first one, the title is Five Awesome Dance Sequences in Movies. Now we made a rule in this that they couldn't actually be movies
that should have dance scenes.
Yeah, because I mean, like Footloose has the original
has awesome 20-minute most gorgeous film. 20 minutes of film ever, but
yeah, it's great dancing, but that's just so easy. You can sit there and be like Singing in the Rain has great ones. But I'm like, it's there. You could, any of the Muppet movies don't count because they're musicals, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. These are movies that have a dance sequence that kind of comes out of nowhere, but it's still awesome. And the first one on the list is Malcolm X, which I'm not a big fan of the movie. I'm not a big fan of Spike Lee, but I have to say when they do the zoot suit scene and they go to the dance club, that is an awesome sequence. That is, I think, the best directed sequence that Spike Lee's ever done in his career. It's fascinating. I can't take my eyes off
of it. I need to rewatch it because I have no memory of this.
Yeah, it's a long movie. You can pretty much turn it off.
Can you tell
before
me
even
what
goes
point
to jail?
The dance comes in. Like, just tell me the minutes, and I'll just fast forward.
Well, it's right at the beginning of the movie. It's pretty early, so you don't have to sit through much of the movie.
Oh, awesome.
So that's when Malcolm X has a fantastic dance sequence in it. You got the next one on the list.
I do have the next one. What
yes,
is the
I
next
just sent
one?
It, to you. I sent it. It would be the one that starts with a G.
No!
The movie I hate.
The one that we argued about?
Yes.
Okay,
I don't remember
so
this, scene.
This is not a good movie. This is
no,
not
it's
a good
not.
Movie
it's
in any way.
Terrible.
Yes, Kevin hates this movie. I understand anybody hating this movie. However, it stars a certain great actor. Known for more of his TV work, named Michael C. Hall, as a villainous video game creator in a future where people are hired to be Sims characters. And for no reason whatsoever, Michael C. Hall does a soft shoe tap dance in Gamer.
and he's controlling other people.
He's controlling other people, and it's like him in a kick line of like 20 other men. And Michael C. Hall is a Broadway guy. He, you know, he was the MC in Cabaret at one point. If you ever watch 6 Feet Under, you see every once in a while he breaks out into song, and you're like, oh, wow, he can actually sing. Yeah. And so seeing him actually get to use his moves in Gamer, it's kind of awesome.
It's an interesting scene nonetheless. I mean, it makes sense, but it still makes no fucking
sense. It doesn't
sense.
Actually make sense, but it's just great to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the only reason to watch that movie.
Fast forward to it. It's at the end.
It is. Yeah, you have to like get like an hour and 10 into it.
Yeah. The next one on the list is Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. This is an obscure comedy from the 70s starring Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman and Madeline Kahn. Oh. It is not a Mel Brooks movie, but Gene Wilder plays Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother, and Marty Feldman's his Watson, and they're trying to solve a crime, a mystery, obviously, and they get stuck in a room with this sort of James Bond-esque device where it's a giant circular saw, and they squeeze up against the wall, and the saw passes by them, and they're able to get out unscathed, and they escape through a ballroom where people are dancing, and they start dancing with each other. Which is, you know, odd enough. I mean, that stands out in the ballroom where they're paired off in couples and they're the two of them in tuxedos. And then everyone stops and stares at them. And what they find out is that the back of their pants had been sawn off by the saw. So they're staring there literally bare ass naked. And, nice. And so then they have this great little dance sequence. And it's a hilarious moment.
And you get to see Gene Wilder's ass.
And Marty Feldman's ass. Oh. Which is wall-eyed.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That was so insensitive and cruel. Anyways, that's my trademark. You've got the next one, which is a hilariously awesomely bad movie.
Oh, okay. Another movie that, well, when you're making a kid's movie, you kind of just need to keep things moving.
Yeah.
So why not have a scene set in McDonald's where all the kids get up and dance with the possibly ugliest alien of all time in cinema.
With the dildo alien.
That is oddly enough supposed to be in a kid's... Like, it's one thing for the aliens in District 9 to be ugly because they're, you know, supposed to be these, like, shrimp thingies. But this is Mac and Me, and it's a movie made for kids.
It's a knockoff of E.T. It's it's literally, and it looks like
it's like somebody ate E.T. and threw him up.
Well,
glued him and like plastered him over to keep him together.
Partially digested E.T.
Yeah.
I described it to somebody as it's sort of like they got like a sixth grader to make their own E.T. in art class.
Gave him some paper mache.
And that's what they ended up with. And they didn't finesse it at all. They're just like, sixth grader, it's the director's son. Here you go.
And the director went on to make another, what's the name of it? Standing Ovation. Do you know Standing Ovation? Fozzie always talks about Standing Ovation.
Fozzie loves that movie. I have not seen it.
I started watching it. I mean, it's insanely bad. Mm-hmm. But watching it, I'm like, God, who made this? And I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. It's the same director as Mac and Me.
Yeah, there's dancing in that one, too.
There is a lot. But it's bad, too.
But the best part about Mac and Me is it's a notoriously known film for all the product placement. And, I mean, E.T. had product placement. Obviously, Reese's Pieces got put on the map by being in that movie. But there's a scene where the kid's eating Skittles and he's drinking Coke. And there's
he has a stomachache, so he takes Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah, literally the alien's called Mac. And they go to McDonald's where they get a Big Mac. And that's, of course, where the dance scene. And it makes... This is what I love about dance scenes in movies. Not musicals, because they're silly and they show up. But movies like this, there is no explanation as to why this dance is happening.
At no other
point in the movie does anyone break out in song and dance. Yet they're all...
Because are they ever at McDonald's?
Well, I guess that's the way this McDonald's works in Arizona or wherever they were where this happened.
The magical place? Oh, speaking of product placement.
Yeah.
Did that bug you in The Dark Knight Rises too?
Which one?
For me, the one that stood out was Saks Fifth Avenue as they're driving. And not because... Like, I understand product placement, and it makes sense. If you're driving down the street, you're going to see a recognizable store. But the fact that the movie set in, quote-unquote, Gotham, and works so hard to not be, even though this one's so clearly New York, but for the most part, generally, they, you know, it could be Chicago, or it could be New York, or it could be Philadelphia. But just whenever there was something so recognizable, it really bothered me.
Yeah. I don't live in New York, so I don't know that. Whereas, like, I just rewatched Superman, the original Superman. And what I love about the Superman movies is they're like Metropolis. And you're like, Metropolis looks really like New York City. Like, to the point that it has a Statue of Liberty.
And it has in Dark Knight, there is the subway, a New York subway stop in there.
Yeah, I mean,
you can see the Wall Street subway stop.
It's so silly. And then, like, in Superman 2, they're like, they have a fight in Times Square. It's Times Square.
It's more they New don't York dress it to Manhattan. Be like
Metropolis Square. No, it's Times fucking Square with the Coke sign and everything. And it's just, that's how I thought they're not even trying at that point.
Yeah,
it's like, fair enough. It's Metropolis, which is also called New York City. So the last one is you'd said was My Blue Heaven.
Mm-hmm. I think, wait, was that 5 or 4?
That was 5.
Okay.
You took the other G movie and did that in front.
Oh, but I didn't say that one out loud.
No, I didn't. That's okay. But you got My Blue Heaven.
Okay, well, I'm going to say My Blue Heaven, but then I'll have to throw in.
We got honorable mentions. We can throw those in.
My Blue Heaven from 1991 or so. It Steve Martin, Rick Moranis, Joan Cusack. I believe it was written by Nora Ephron. And I'm not generally a big fan of her stuff. It's very chickish for me.
I'm not a big fan of Nora Ephron. I mean, God rest her soul.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think she was a very important figure and did create a genre. And for that genre, her stuff is, for the most part, very good.
But Nora Ephron created this genre. I think Nancy Meyers perfected Nora Ephron movies, is how I would
say. I could see that. My Blue Heaven, though, it's not really a Nora Ephron. It's much more a Steve Martin movie. Yeah. And it is, Steve Martin is this mobster who, very Ray Liotta character from Goodfellas, very Henry Hill-esque. And he's in the Witness Protection Program, so he moves to this very Ohio suburb, and it's very suburban. And Rick Moranis is the FBI agent assigned to protect him and everything. And, of course, it's Rick Moranis and, you know, Steve Martin doing his Italian thing.
Doesn't quite work as a mob boss, but okay.
Oh, whatever, you go with it. So, but throughout it, Steve Martin is trying to, like, make Richard,
Rick Moranis,
my goodness. One of my early crushes.
Richard Moranis.
Blah, blah, blah.
As his friends call him. I have a crush on Rick Moranis. Bobby De Niro and Stevie Martin.
He's trying to make Rick Moranis cool. So he teaches him how to dance the merengue. Yeah. And there's a couple of moments in the movie where there's one big sequence where the two of them are dancing like at a club. And it's just like this big scene. And then there's a shootout. But then a better scene comes later where Rick Moranis is now like cool with it. So he's dancing with Joan Cusack, who of course is like 2 feet taller than him. And meanwhile, in the background, you have Bill Irwin, who is an incredible dancer, and he's just doing, you know, making pretzels out of his body in the background, and it's just several really fun dance sequences in a non-musical movie.
Yep. Cool.
Sure, if you haven't seen it, revisit it. I think you'd be
surprised.
I
saw it like 20 years ago.
Okay. Well, it's funny, and it holds up.
The honorable mentions, you had the other G movie.
My other G movie was Grind from 2000, I think. It is a terrible movie about skateboarders. 2002,
because I was actually reviewing movies.
Was it 2002?
I think it was 2002, yeah.
Wow, we used to watch it in college all the time.
That's so awful.
It's not good at all, but it's about like skateboarders going across the country to a big skate competition where Bang Bangera is in charge, and it's a terrible movie. But at one point, they stop at a bar, and like, out of nowhere, they kind of all dance, and apparently these four stoner high schoolers have choreography, and they do it, and it's great.
Oh, nice. Now, the other honorable mention I have is The Fisher King, which kind of was the first example I used, but we found other better examples. So it got knocked off the list, but The Fisher King has the dance in Grand Central Station, which actually was shot in Grand Central Station. They shut it down for like an hour to shoot the sequence, which... It's a brilliant scene because it's unlike all the other ones, it totally fits in the nature of the film,
right?
Even though it's not a musical. So it's a brilliantly shot film. It's one of Terry Gilliam's better movies.
Terry Gilliam and I have a complicated relationship.
Really?
Usually, with exception, I just find I get a headache after watching his films.
He's got like a handful of genius movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else is sort of...
Like, and I understand why people... And I get in trouble for this. I don't... Brazil, not a fan.
I like Brazil.
I like things about it. I think the approach is interesting. I think the visuals are great. It's just... Watching that movie is kind of like having somebody punch me in the back of the head for 2.5 hours. Or an hour and a half, depending on which cut I'm watching.
Yeah, it depends. And then you can... Do you punch you back in the head and then give you like an ice cream sundae for the Love Conquers All ending?
Well, no, because I'm not happy at that point because the actress is so blah. So, you know, I'll take an ice cream sundae if that's how it's going to end. But I'm never going to turn that down if you want to give me
for
ice cream
right now. Yeah, for me, I think The Fisher King's great. I think All his Monty Python stuff's great, but that's sort of outside of his realm. The Fisher King's great. 12 Monkeys in Brazil are my favorite ones. Other ones, like even Baron Munchausen, which is visionary and wonderful, but it's still kind of weird, loud
and chaotic, and
it doesn't quite work. And like, you know, Fear and Loathing, a lot of people love that, but I'm like, I mean, I'm not a huge Hunter S. Thompson fan. I think it's a great adaptation of the book. I'm just not
right.
Wild
and it makes
about
sense
it.
For him to adapt that.
Yeah, and it's a great adaptation of the book too. I mean, it's one of those unadaptable books that actually was done well.
Right.
So, anyways, with that, I think that's it. So we're gonna go ahead and go to a break, and when we come back, we will talk more DVDs. About DVDs.
And that means I can't curse anymore.
That's right. And welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. If you missed us in the middle segment, we are talking about... We talked about a good amount of stuff. We actually dissected The Dark Knight Rises a little bit more.
We did a lot of Bane voice.
We did some Bane voices, and we do want to... I do want to hear a mashup of Batman as Batman and Bane, like reciting some famous dialogue sequence.
Oh, that's good. I just want to hear them like driving somewhere together in a carpool and like one of them giving directions to the other and them arguing about it.
Oh, that would be great. So where do I turn? Turn here at the left, Batman.
You said make a right.
Are you saying the right or the left? To the left, sir. Port
that's
side.
A stoplight.
I mean, I just would. That would be
work.
Brilliant.
They should do GPS with Bane's voice.
I mean, I would love it. You'd love to be, if I were working to like a customer service thing to pick up the phone and be like, "Hello, this is Bane talking. I can help you now. Can I have your account number?"
Then people would be like, "Why is Sean Connery working at Walmart?"
Yeah, why is an insane Sean Connery doing this? But anyway, so we have a good bunch of stuff. We talk about great dance scenes in movies and answer some listener
email.
But what do we have coming up here now?
We have the time for the world famous DVD roundup.
That's right. Aha. I always feel have a sense of accomplishment when I make that thing work.
That one kind of sounded more like a noisemaker for New Year's than the typical whip.
Oh my God, everyone's a critic.
Just from this side. Maybe, you know, maybe it sounds different on air.
I know. It sounds brilliant on air, of course.
Sounds brilliant.
Like me going back in the old days, like that was any better.
I thought you still did that.
No, I used the app. I got it from the Big Bang Theory turned me on to it. There's actually an app for a whipping sound.
Oh, so.
I also have an app. What's funny is there's an app for everything, and none of the apps have any sort of pragmatic use. They're all just silliness. Like I have a Rimshot app.
You never know when you need to use that.
And on this one, if you like tell a bad joke, like you go, "Oh, well, you know, why did the what's black and white and red all over? A skunk in the blender."
Sad trombone.
Yeah, sad trombone. Nice. Crickets and golf clap and all that good stuff.
Yeah, remember we used to have to carry trombones with us.
Yeah, I know, and like a snare drum and a bag of crickets if you wanted to do it. Anyways, let's talk DVDs and Blu-rays. What's yours? You've got a couple that you wanted to throw down first.
Oh yeah, the highlights for me is finally on Blu-ray the director's cut of The Island of Dr. Moreau,
which of course everybody needs.
It just the fact that there could be more of this movie just makes me really happy. And I'm guessing
movie
this
is such
all
a
the Frankenheimer director. Because originally it was Richard Stanley, who was fired after, I think, like 3 days. Apparently for being even crazier than everybody else associated with that movie.
This is a terrible movie,
It's terrible, but it's so fascinatingly terrible. Yeah. It's because it's fat Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer, who then apparently like got the diet plan shortly after this, but from Marlon Brando. Because look, right after this movie is when things went downhill for Val Kilmer. You could trace it back to this movie.
I'm sure.
And where you can still see like the hearing aid in Marlon Brando's ear because he just didn't want to learn the lines to the movie. It's amazing. Yeah. And there's also a Steve Austin double pack of action movies. I'm recommending this because one of the movies called Hunt to Kill. It's not that good, but it features...
<It's> stunned! That's amazing revelation you just dropped on us.
I know. I'm just so outside my comfort zone right now. The thing about this movie, though, is that Gil Bellows plays the villain. And Gil Bellows, you probably remember from Ally McBeal, where he was Ally McBeal's, like, the love of her life. And he's, like, kind of a skinny guy. He looks more like he should be, like, you know, more like a lawyer ever. Because, I mean, that's what he was in Notting Hill. And so it seems like when they cast him in this role, he was not supposed to be cast. Like, they were supposed to, he was supposed to read the part of henchman number one or the accountant to the bad guy. But he took this role and he just tries to milk it. And it's so awkward to watch. But he just gives it his all. And for that reason, I, you know, just watch Hunt to Kill for him.
All right. Well, good. And the other ones that I've got, you've got Silent House, which is on DVD and Blu-ray, which is an interesting movie remake of an Uruguay thriller, but it's not at all something that should have been released wide. It did get released wide because Elizabeth Olsen kind of got some street cred. Right. But it's not a great movie, but it's worth checking out. Boss Season 1, which is the Kelsey Grammer store
and the
show.
Award-winning, right? Or Golden Globe award-winning.
It's good. My biggest problem with it is just sort of it's that very dour, just to be dour. It's sort of like The Killing or... You know, where it's just, it's very grim, but it shows a real seedy side of politics. So that's an interesting movie, or it's a TV show. Season 2 starting up on Stars. You've also got Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1 on Blu-ray, which is, they've remastered everything.
Nice.
For that. And Game of Thrones Season 1, which I don't watch because I don't have HBO. And it's almost like now I'm like the hipster thing.
Well,
like,
this
isn't the
first release of this. This is the re-release after they pulled it because of the George Bush head.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because this I got my Game of Thrones Blu-ray months ago. They yanked it from the market because of the whole George Bush thing, and now
we got to move on because we got about a minute left. Stinker of the week is Touched by an Angel, the fifth season, just because that show was just downright terrible. And you said you put I Spit on the Grave two spit on
well,
your grave
because they're doing
two-pack.
A 2-pack, and the original film special edition DVD has a lot of really great special features on it. If they carried those over to the Blu-ray, then sure, get it, because then you get the remake in there for free. But if they didn't, then just stick with the original, because the remake is just weird and not very
good. All right,
good, but...
we got to wrap up here. Review wrap up. We Step Up Revolution. I say kind of rocks for what it is, but I think it still kind of sucks. The Watch gets a preemptive suck, and Ruby Sparks gets a sucks just because I did not. It's not my kind of movie. Next week we're going to be talking about the Total Recall remake. We're going to recall, and then we are also going to talk about Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, and we have about 15 seconds left. So Emily, tell us where you are, where to find you aside from being in the Bronx.
Okay, deadlydollshouse.com, Deadly Dolls on Twitter, and Gleekast with a K, GLEEKAST, in the iTunes store.
All right, sounds good. We will talk to you all next week. Have a good weekend.
Later.
Like the show you just heard? Then head on over to FatGuysAtTheMovies.com to hear more. Fat Guys Network flagship show, Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The Idiot Boxers with Kevin and Merrill. Celluloid Spotlight with Merrill and Hash. And if you like any of what you hear, kick us a few bucks using the donation button on the sidebar. Or just leave us an iTunes review. Fat Guys Network is where the ooey-gooey podcasting goodness is at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.